I mean, the idea of there being some sort of...
House Committee on Revenue for February 8th, 2017 will come to order. We're going to open our meeting today at the top of the agenda with the information meeting on the tax credit report from the Legislative Revenue Office. Officer Paul.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As you recall, there was legislation that was approved in 2013 that directed us to, before each long session, to prepare a report on the sunsetting tax credits. And that has occupied much of Chris's time over the last few months. So he has put together the report, and it's on OLIS for you, and he'll go through it with the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So as Paul mentioned, this is the second round of the tax credit report. It's the fourth round of the tax credit review process, so we've gone back to the original group from 2011. A couple things about what it is or is not. This document is not a listing of, it's not an advocacy piece for any tax credit, and it's neither an opposition piece to any tax credit. So it's designed to get all sides mad at us for talking about the tax credit. The structure of the report is identical pretty much to the first one. We didn't get much feedback on how to change it, so we didn't really change it. The first two sections of the report are kind of headers. The first one is a review of tax expenditure concepts and what they are and what we're talking about when we mention tax expenditures. And then the second section is a review of the tax credit review process. The meat of the report, if you will, or the bulk of it, is in Section 3, and there are about 15 tax credits that are included here. And they are organized by policy section. We have economic development, housing, and energy are the primary three. And then we have a couple of natural resource credits, and then another category that deals with a fire insurance credit. There is one tax credit that is a repeat from last time, and that's the rural medical provider tax credit. Mm-hmm. And that's because it was extended for just 2 years last session, so it falls under that group of sunsetting in the upcoming year. The housing tax credits actually don't sunset until January 1, 2020, but they're included. They fall under the category of tax credits needing a little bit longer lead time for review by the legislature. So they're in the mix this time. So I wasn't planning on walking through the document in a lot of detail. I'm just trying to bring it at a high level and then answer any questions or review any other details that you'd like me to. But the meat of it, if you will, for each tax credit, the information provided, there are four sections. There's a policy purpose section. There's a description section. Another section for miscellaneous information, normally dealing with administrative issues or tax credits offered by other states that are similar. And then there's a policy or impact analysis section, and it kind of goes through that. So I just wanted to touch on some themes that emerged as I was putting together the report that might be helpful as the legislature goes through the process this time. And some of those themes, we get back at clarifying the policy purpose. So right now, the policy committees have these tax credits in them, and to the extent that they can and are willing to do so, clarity around the policy purpose statement is a first step for evaluating these. To evaluate a policy, it needs to be clear, or as clear as possible, what that policy goal is, especially under the context of potentially no longer needing a tax credit or meeting that goal and then deciding the tax credit is no longer necessary. So that's where having a goal in mind can be met, because we get into a conversation of when does an incentive become a subsidy? And that's not necessarily a clear answer, and it can be tricky. But to that end, any metrics that can be tied to the policy purposes would go a long way in helping stakeholders and the construction of the report next time around. And the metrics don't have to be grandiose. They can be simple. Anything that's put along those lines really helps move the discussion forward about basically what the legislature is paying for with these tax credits. A lot of these, especially the economic development tax credits, get caught up in this debate around the but-for question about whether or not the activity would have occurred anyway. And Each section does include, or for the most part, there's a literature search, literature review, academic journals on some of these policies, evaluating whether or not they do what they do or how effective they are. And that question, that but-for question, is very difficult. It's relevant, but it's very difficult and very elusive to get at. So I would urge the Assembly to just consider one step at a time in gathering information and setting up a process for gathering that information as we move forward, because now is the time, to the extent that any of these tax credits are extended and move forward, now would be the time to lay out the playing field, if you will, about expectations for next time around. And in many ways, one could argue that this tax credit report is a piece of that process. So just discussing the value of the metrics and the value of data collection, who would be responsible for that and the process, and keeping it simple so administrative costs for anything don't erode the value of any particular tax credit. And really getting back to that first step, being understanding what the state is paying for by using these tax credits. So the other piece I wanted to touch on are differences from the first report. There are three sections in this report that are a little bit different from the prior one. Section 4 of the report is a section on tax credit transferability. There are 6 active tax credits that can be transferred. And by an active tax credit, I mean there can be a new taxpayer claiming the credit for the first time this year. It doesn't, basically, I'm excluding tax credits that have already sunset. And of those 6 tax credits, there have been a lot of discussion about the transferability of certain tax credits and the prices that go along with those tax credits and how that process works. I think in the House side, there's even a bill that contains language that would create one statute for the transferability of tax credits. So the Assembly could basically say, for any tax credit, if you want that tax credit to be transferable, it would just point to this statute, and that creates hopefully clarity and uniformity for the transfer of tax credits. And it may or may not be the case that all of the transferable tax credits could fit into a structure, but at least moves that discussion forward. The other two pieces in here that are different from the first report, there is a history of the process in Appendix D. And as you may recall, the sunsets were established in 2009, and the process has existed since 2011. And as we've moved forward, this is basically just a record keeping of everything that's gone on with the credits since that time. And then the last thing that's new to this report is Appendix E. House Bill 3542, which was passed last time, required LRO to provide a list of tax credits and their initial estimates along with their actuals so that you can see easily what the estimated revenue impact was and what it actually was. So this is required for the first time. It's included in here just for tax year 2014. There is a lag to when we have tax return information available to us. The most recent at this point was tax year 2014. So the tax credits that are included in that table were modified between 2011 and 2014, most of them occurring in the 2013 session. So in that table, there's that record of what the estimated impact was and what it actually was in 2014. And that list will grow as we move forward through time as actuals become available. So that's a very quick high-level touch on the pieces of the tax report. I'm happy to go into any more detail if there are any questions, or if you'd like me to touch on any particular issue in a little more detail.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. So are we going to have a bill for each of these that basically gives us a vehicle to decide whether or not we're going to extend them or let them expire, or do they just automatically expire we have to do a bill to keep them going?
Let me start on that. LRO, at my request, and I think the request of Senator Hass, put together bills that would extend existing tax credits that are expiring at the end of this year or beginning of next year, and maybe a couple of others later than that, for an additional 6 years. That's all the bill does. Those bills were sent to the Senate and the House policy committees to consider the question of whether or not the the subject matter of the tax credit bill was appropriate. If they send the bills on, most of those bills, I think, have a subsequent referral to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, mm-hmm. of which you are a member because you're a member of this committee.
I know.
That committee hasn't met yet,
yep.
and may or may not meet, depending upon whether it gets any bills to work. The way that's worked in the past, and there's no guarantee it'll work that way again, is that the Joint Tax Credit Committee has built its single bill based on the recommendations of the policy committees and the dollars available to be expended on tax credits. Now, if I've missed it somehow, please correct me, but that's been under the direction of the committee chairs or the co-chairs, the co-chairs of the Joint Tax Committee, Senator Hass and myself.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Please.
So can you scroll down just a little bit so I can see something? Where's the one for rural providers?
It's right here.
Other?
It's an other.
All right, so that was one we were supposed to deal with last session in the healthcare committee, and we punted. We said we don't have enough information to know if it's working the way we were supposed to or not. I don't know. I'll check in on if that's in my committee or not, or if Rep. Greenlick has a plan for it. My fear is that we will punt again, that we...
May I inquire, what does punt mean?
Means that we claimed we didn't know enough to decide whether it was a good idea or a bad idea.
And therefore...
And so we continued it for 2 years, hoping a report would reveal to us whether it was a good idea or a bad idea.
We haven't talked about that.
Representative Bueller is in the same committee. I mean, his memory might be different than mine, but...
Yeah.
No, similar.
Thank you. Representative Benson could get me off the hook.
Yeah. Well, we, of course, spent a lot of time in the waning days on that tax credit.
We did.
On rural providers?
Yeah, and eventually it emerged the considerable challenge that it is. And we all told each other on the floor of the House and elsewhere that, by God, we got to fix this because it's a mess. And it still is a mess, as far as I know, unless there's some secret group working way to fix it.
Yeah.
That's what.
Please, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher, or Mr. Chair. I was under the understanding, I believed that there was going to be a group that looked at the range of policy options, both tax expenditures, tax credits, appropriations, whose overall goal was to help rural areas attract and retain more healthcare providers. So that group clearly either did not meet or did not form. And
they
is that right, Chris? See how I turn that into a question?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith Winter, that the vehicle for that was House Bill 3396, and it required the I'm going to get the names mixed up that Oregon Health Board to commission a report. They hired the Lewin Group, I believe it was, to conduct a report, and the Lewin Group submitted that report through those channels.
Yeah.
So that report was done, and it was all of the incentives, direct and indirect, for rural areas of the state.
I feel like we had that report actually already in 2015. And that I may be misremembering. I thought we already had the report, and there was still a discussion of, okay, well, we actually need real people who live here to sit around and work through it and come up with a proposal. Am I remembering that wrong? Is that report more recent than that?
There certainly could be different reports. The report I'm recalling was finalized in 2016. And I got a copy of it, and it's referenced in here in some of their conclusions relating to the tax credit. It was much broader, getting at all of the incentives, loan forgiveness, loan repayment, those other kinds of programs.
And that's a useful thing, because often this committee doesn't even know about the other incentives that don't relate to taxes directly. So having that information is very helpful. And I think the Health Committee certainly ought to have that in their consideration of this kind of bill. Representative Nellis.
So maybe we could ask our staff to. I feel like I would know. I should know about that report.
Yeah,
I don't.
I agree.
So maybe we could just send it out to the members of the committee, and then I'll check in with Representative Greenlick if we're doing anything with it in health or not. I'd like to see the report, since I don't have any memory of it.
Now, Representative Bass?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was going to ask what the plan is. Perhaps you were going to tell us. So if you're going to get that, then I'm going to ask him, ask our fine economist a question about some language in the, in that what she's presenting us, just as a simple question.
Yeah. Well, just to finish up, if that's possible with this conversation, we really violated our own process last time when we did what you described a minute ago in the Tax Credit Committee, because what we had from the Health Committee was, I'll put it a slightly different way, was not particularly helpful in the process.
Hunted.
Yeah, exactly.
We didn't give you any help.
Yeah. No. So the way this process was supposed to work was if the substantive committee thought that the subject matter ought to be continued because the incentive was a useful incentive for the purposes that that committee thought was a useful policy, I'm getting a head nod, so I must be getting it close to right, then they should send the bill on to the Tax Credit Committee for further consideration. And what our original position was, when Senator Burdick was the co-chair, was that we weren't going to consider tax credits that hadn't been sent on to us from either the Senate committee or the House committee on the grounds that obviously nobody cared about it enough to send it to us. I think, and I don't know whether we got a bill from the Senate committee. I think maybe we did. Mm-hmm. We did get a bill from the Senate committee, so we didn't violate our procedure, as it turns out. But that Senate bill wasn't particularly helpful to us either, as it turned out. My inclination, just so you know, and so people are on fair warning, if the substantive committees can't figure it out, they shouldn't expect us to.
Exactly. I agree.
Please,
Mr.
Go ahead.
Chair, so the substantive committee couldn't figure it out, in my opinion, 2 years ago. We,
yes,
well, but there's a lot of people that like that money or depend on it.
Policy committee, do your work.
Well, so the policy committee did not feel like it had good information from which to judge,
yeah.
All right? And so that's why I was wondering about this report that was done that I don't know about. Did it help discern whether or not loans would be better, or after 10 years a person's put roots down and we don't have to keep giving them a tax credit, or is it only people that commute from the valley to work in those areas to take advantage of the tax credit? And maybe that's what we have to do, but like we couldn't figure it out, other than we all sort of believe anybody that's getting a benefit would tell us in a survey, sure, it's nice to get it, we like it.
All right. Let me give you a different example that may or may not be helpful. Several years ago, there was a tax credit for farmers who gave a portion of their crop to the food bank. That tax credit disappeared. It just simply wasn't renewed because nobody came in to ask us for it. No one came in to ask us for it. Well, you can be sure, because it turned out it was important, they did come back and ask for it again. And I had several meetings during interim with people from the Oregon Food Bank, from the Lane County, boy, I'm going to mess it up here, aren't I? The equivalent in Lane County, and Food for Lane County, that's right, that's what it is. And the result of that was that we ended up considering again and reinstating it. But we did follow our process, which was if you don't show up and ask, you don't get it.
Okay. Certain attraction to that.
Yeah. It turned out that was a valuable item for them, but they hadn't told us that, so we didn't know. Anything else for Chris now? Now, look, I will ask him to distribute that report and so that you can read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest it, so you're ready for the next conversation on the topic. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really, two comments. First, the rural health provider tax credit is extraordinarily valuable to the rural areas of Oregon. I would hate to jerk that out from underneath the feet of those who are working like...
Mm-hmm. They are.
Representative Buehler used to work... Oh, sorry. Now, I would just say that we wouldn't want to let that expire without due warning to all of the people who have come to rely upon it and amazingly rural areas. So if we need to tell them to storm down to the healthcare committee, we should do so then, if that's what I'm hearing. So we will turn them loose.
Yeah.
That's what I think needs to happen.
Okay, you will.
And we've got a couple of members of the healthcare committee who can pass that message back to the chair.
And then the second thing, I just have a question for Chris.
Why don't you ask it, and then we'll go to Representative Bueller.
So in the first paragraph of tax expenditures, you use the word normative as opposed to established. And I was curious why.
That's a good question. The established is what I think is used in Oregon statute for the tax expenditure report, which I think might be the basis for the question.
Correct.
And normative, I was trying not to be that statutory, if you will, and bring it up to, well, what is considered a normal tax base? And it is an open question, and normative perhaps is a little bit broader, but that's what I intended it to be, to not have that weight of a statutory term.
Okay, that's adequate. Thank you.
Representative Bueller.
I'm going to return to the rural provider tax credit topic. I think some of the difficulty is for the advocates to prove the effectiveness of it. I haven't been convinced one way or the other. I think it's an important thing to incentivize rural providers, and I'm not sure this is the best way. So I think when we consider this, it's not only, you know, yay or nay on the dollar amount, but is there a better way that we can put those funds to use, potentially even leveraging other dollars, or just be more impactful to attracting and keeping providers in those smaller rural towns?
If I
please,
this topic might be a good example of what I was touching on a little bit earlier about when I was talking about metrics. A lot of the question, and I think the core question is exactly what you're talking about right now. Is it effective or not? Does it do what it's supposed to do? And that kind of work can be debated and for a long time, and there can be a lot of inconclusive work. That's just the nature of a lot of the social science work. So short of having somebody come forward with a definitive paper, yes, this absolutely works, or there's no way this absolutely does not work, I think there's a lot the legislature can do, and even in terms of metrics and asking for specific data points. So on this particular issue, being clear and perhaps requiring that somehow, I'm not sure exactly what the process is, that certain metrics, rural providers per population, something along those lines that kind of move toward that notion of effective or not. Because for a lot of the incentives, I view them on both sides. So if somebody is a strong, determined advocate for tax credit A, I'm not sure what kind of work would exist to come in and indisputably prove that it doesn't work to convince that person that it doesn't work. So what I'm suggesting is kind of changing the dialogue about one step at a time and what kind of information is relevant. So specialties per population or measures of healthcare in these areas, collecting that information over time might be useful.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, and Chris is absolutely right. You know, I'm all about data-driven policy making. It becomes very difficult sometimes in the social sciences arena because there's so many factors and it's hard to control for all those. And so sometimes you just have to, instead of using, you know, inductive reasoning, where can I, you do it from the data on up, you have to use deductive and just say, hey, this series of logical arguments makes sense that it's going to, say, in this case, influence behavior. And then, you know, observe it for a while and see if it worked. Because I think you're right. In this case, it's going to be very difficult to prove that a $5,000, you know, provider tax credit is the predominant influence in getting a family doc to come to John Day, for example. I mean, we all know there's so many factors that go into that. To unwind that and get it down to that factor is tough.
And on that particular one, there's a recruitment and retention layer. So there are two aspects there. And there are different ways and different kinds of studies. You can do survey information. You can do statistical. It's almost building a body of work.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Fellow Vice Chair. I agree, and I apologize if this was said before, but and I would just argue that I think you do use that deductive
reasoning, and you don't just do it on this, you say, what are all the things that we are doing to incentivize that, and let's look at them all together and then come up with that series and do some sort of, even if it's a, okay, we only have X number of dollars to use, so is it wiser to use it on this end or wiser to use it on this end, rather than using, maybe even you spend the same amount of money, but instead of splitting it between those couple of things, you say, you fashion a thing to say, this is the most effective, so let's spend it all this way instead of spreading it out and hoping, you know, and hoping that it works.
Representative Buehler.
And I'll disclose my bias in this topic right now. I think the data is really clear that there is a high probability, around 70% chance, that if you train someone in a rural area, the chance they'll stay in that community after training is about 70%. My preference is we should invest dollars in training providers in rural communities, and there's a big multiplier to that, because each person you train in those areas, they need five jobs to support that one doc training program. So it's also an economic multiplier. So that's my bias in this topic. And there is evidence to support that in terms of also the multiplier of the jobs produced and also the likelihood that someone will stay in the location that they're trained in. Mm-hmm.
But you don't get a great show like Northern Exposure out of training there.
Mr. Chair, we're just finishing the conversation. We've made no progress.
We're still spinning.
We had a nice discussion.
Very effectively.
I think what's going on is a debate about who does all the work, and we've determined the healthcare committee.
Yes. There,
that's what we've determined.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Someone else is the shortest.
Someone else is the shortest. And, of course, Representative Greenlee doesn't have anything else to do, so he can spend full time on this issue. That, of course, is a facetious comment because he's got to figure out how to manage the Oregon Health Plan, which is not a trivial problem. Anything else for Chris right now? We're not done with this conversation. It'll go on for a long time, and I would commend this report to your careful review in addition to the material that Representative Nosa requested.
After 2 or 3 years.
Just add, so, Mr. Chair, now, Chris is, as part of this process, Chris is available to go to the policy committee. So he'll be in right. and out of those committees here over the next few weeks. He'll have the report and the tax expenditure report. So they'll have some basis to start from. And this will be a resource for them.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. And you've heard this conversation. That will be helpful, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Please.
Well, in response to that, I think, would this be a good opportunity to just forward this preemptively to those committee chairs, everything that pertains to their topic that they might address, so they'd have the information, and then if they want to have you come testify and explain it, maybe that would help this process to go along.
There is some variance across the committees on how the chairs like to handle it, but generally that is what happens. Yeah. We just pull off. That's part of the reason it's organized the way it is. So economic development, that gets pulled out and sent to that committee.
Okay. Yep. Very good. Thanks.
Good. Great. Anything else for Chris right now? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the information meeting. Paul, how do we organize this piece?
We're back to these. Actually, Chris has these two bills.
66 and 54?
Right. Uh-huh.
All right. They're completely different issues, though, aren't they?
They are different issues.
Okay, all right. We'll close the information meeting, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2066. Chris, do you want to bring us up to date on this bill? And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2066 does two things. It has a technical correction and then a policy extension. The technical correction is in Section 1, and it pertains to the definition of logger. If you're looking at the bill, it's in lines 10 and 11, and it just deletes language that says who is paid on a per unit cut basis. And it's viewed, this is a technical cleanup issue in that it doesn't have any real effect. The loggers are no longer paid this way, and so it's just extraneous language. It's kind of been on our cleanup list for a little while, mm-hmm. And it made it into the bill this time. But that's all that is.
Okay.
The more substantive piece is in Section 3, and this extends the film rebate, the qualifying film production labor rebate program, 6 years. And what that program is businesses that are filming in Oregon, if they spend at least $1 million in Oregon, then they qualify for a rebate of up to 6.2% of their payroll in Oregon, and that comes out of the withholding payments. So these companies make the withholding payments on behalf of their employees while they're doing production, and then I believe it's quarterly to the if once they've shown the film and video office that they've spent the $1 million, mm-hmm. then the Department of Revenue issues rebates to these companies up to 6.2% of their payroll.
Okay. We have a sign up for this bill?
Nobody signed up.
Nobody signed up. I wonder if they knew about it. The heading is odd.
It's very odd.
Blank?
Maybe nobody had any concern about
it. Blank. You know, one of the things that... I have two questions. First one, do we know why the bill came here instead of one of the substantive committees? Any idea?
I do not know that. I can look into that. I'm not sure why.
And then I noticed that when you look at the short statement in the public hearing, it only refers to loggers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't refer to the second piece of the bill, which is actually quite a bit more substantive.
And which is also what they're relating to, of
course. Tax expenditures, of course, means you can put anything in this bill that relates to tax credits, deductions, exemptions, et cetera, all kinds of tax expenditures, including property tax expenditures, I think, the way this related clause. So maybe that's why we're holding this hearing, is I just may have answered my own question. All right. Any questions about this bill? I would say this before we get to that. If we just go ahead with the film and video extension that's in here, and we don't get a substantive committee report on that topic in connection with another bill, then I think we need to hold a real public hearing on that piece so that we can get the film and video people to explain to us why they need it, and we'll have to notice it in a different way so that they understand that this is the time they should be here for that purpose. Unless there's something substantive, I plan to propose we close this public hearing and go on to the next bill. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just, because they're like different, whole different chunks of ORS, even, yeah. Why is this logger, does anyone know why this logger thing is in this particular? Chris, Elsie, anyone?
So this is a technical fix, you think, huh?
My understanding.
The first part.
No longer language, yeah.
The second part is definitely not a technical fix.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm trying to slip it in.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and they're both in this bill, to my knowledge, because they both relate to subtractions, the logger subtraction, and this isn't an actual extension of the entire Greenlight Labor program. As far as I know, it's related to the subtraction for the taxable income for the income that they receive because of the Greenlight Labor program.
Gotcha.
So they're both subtractions, and I believe that is why they're in the same bill, and they're both tax expenditures. Does that help clarify?
It does.
Okay.
It doesn't change our need to hold a hearing, but it
right.
But
that's
that
why
issue.
They're in the same.
So, in one sense, both of these pieces are technical fixes.
Mr. Chair, I believe so.
The second one doesn't have any effect if the tax credit goes away.
If the Greenlight labor is not extended, I believe that subtraction would be nothing to subtract.
That would be right.
Yeah. But if the other is technical, it's just the nature of the business since the 70s, it's changed.
Okay. All right. Well, my proposal then, colleagues, is that we ask Chris to keep track of Section 3. And if in fact, the film and video tax credit is extended, this probably should go in that bill if it fits in that bill, in the relating clause.
The tax credit is a different part of statute.
Right.
And that is not part of the review process. The
Oh, that's not part of the review this year.
Right. What happens here, so the rebate program, the 6.2, the money that goes is rebated back to the businesses, that is taxable income in the eyes of the federal government.
Correct.
So when the program was established, a business entity gets their rebate check, they have to report it on their federal tax return, and they pay federal income tax on that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the policy here is, well, we've just, for the state, we've just given you this money, so we're not going to then turn around and tax it, and that's why the subtraction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chair.
Okay. But now, just to make sure I understand, the film and video tax credit ends when?
2024.
Okay, so this simply updates what we've already done. Thank you. That's helpful. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you.
Policy's already been decided, in effect. This is a detail to fix.
Well, they're different.
They're different policies. Okay, so the film and video credit is, that credit is sold at auction.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And currently we can sell either $12 or $14 million. I forget which year.
Right.
And that, the Department of Revenue holds an auction, and you can go online and bid on tax credits of $500 at a time for increments. And so the $12 million will be issued in tax credits. That money goes into the, I believe it's the OPIF fund. And then that money is used by the Film and Video Office. They distribute that as an incentive to get business here, to get the filming here. A separate and additional incentive is this rebate program, where it says, if even if you don't get OPIF funds, they can be combined, but even if you don't get OPIF funds, if you film in Oregon and you spend at least $1 million in Oregon and add $1 million to the Oregon economy, then you are eligible for a rebate, a refund, if you will, of up to about 6% of your payroll.
And where does that come
payroll
from?
Tax.
Where does that money come from?
That comes from withholding taxes. So with the businesses are filming, and they withhold their state income taxes from their employees, and they do this, from what I understand, for the most part on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. They remit those withholding tax payments to the Department of Revenue.
Is this essentially a gain share program? I mean, it sounds like it's the same mechanism as a gain share.
It's,
the money comes off the top before it ever gets to the general fund.
It's a redirecting of withholding taxes.
Okay. Well, you know, am I the only one here who doesn't know about this program? I may be the only one who doesn't know about it. You don't know about it either. Okay.
All right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it is in our tax expenditure report,
I believe.
I don't remember the number, but it is there, and there's information about it. It's called the Greenlight Labor or Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate.
Okay. To be careful about the tax expenditure, the cost of the tax expenditure is a couple $100,000. A biennium.
Yes.
The subtraction.
The subtraction.
Yes.
The subtraction.
The thing that this bill applies to.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
The program itself is a rebate. I believe it's about $5 million a year or a biennium. I'd have to check on that. And it's this $5 million that is not subject to tax. And that's, so the $5 million, I'm going to run with $5 million, and that gets rebated to the companies.
Okay.
Because they had sufficient payroll and they spent enough in the state.
Okay.
So this $5 million goes back to these companies. These companies then have to take that $5 million and when they file their federal taxes, report that as taxable income. Because it was income to them.
Right.
It was not a refund of taxes or anything like that. It's income to them. So they pay federal income tax on that $5 million. When they go to file their Oregon tax return, they get to subtract that $5 million because the policy was, we're not going to give you the money and then tax it. So there's a lot of confusion, and there's a difference between the direct money through the rebate program and then the tax expenditure, because those dollar amounts are very different. One is the amount going to the companies, and the other is the tax not collected.
Okay.
That money.
Okay. That's a helpful orientation. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would argue that you're giving it to them twice. In some way, that you're both, they're both getting the expenditure plus not getting taxed on it.
I think that Representative Smith-Warner and I agree that it would be not useful for us to hold a work session on this bill without an additional hearing and ask the people who have an interest in this provision to come and tell us why we ought to extend it. Just a quick yes or heads up or down, is that a reasonable thing? To ask that somebody who wants this actually come and explain to us why they ought to have it, or an extension. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. That's helpful. Is there anything else we should do on this bill today before we get that, before we make that invitation, and add that descriptor to the next notice for a hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think I did speak.
Representative Hernandez.
I believe I spoke with the Oregon Film. I can't remember their name, but they're actually a commission off of the governor's office, but not connected. And they did mention something around this.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I still think
they should be here, though, if they want to talk about getting an extension on this bill. This is a subset of the topic that Representative Nosa raised earlier, in effect. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2066, open a public hearing on House Bill 2054. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are two large changes here. There's one about a rulemaking authority for DOR, and then a number of changes to the Working Family Dependent Care Credit are the themes there. In Section 1, if you have the bill pulled up, in lines 22 through 26, you'll see some language that's being deleted. What this is there are a number of, the state offers a number of credits against the C Corporation tax, and then in this statute, the legislature then identifies those tax credits that can be claimed by the shareholders of S corporations. Within this language, the Department of Revenue was granted rulemaking authority to decide that if a credit isn't specifically listed here, that they would, that the S corporations would still get it. And I believe you're going to hear some of that background from Deanna when she testifies.
Okay.
So the second piece, beginning in Section 2, gets to the Working Family Dependent Care Credit. And for those who may recall, this was a new credit created in 2015. It was a merger of two existing tax credits. This was the tax credit where a lot of work was done in Rep. Kenny Geyer's committee. It merged the old Working Family Child Care Credit and the Dependent Care Credit. And what this does here, just to bounce through them quickly, in line 16 through 18 on page 2, it prevents a double dipping kind of situation. It prevents taxpayers from getting a tax credit against expenses that were funded with pre-tax dollars. So this is a, I believe it's a cafeteria plan where employees can set aside kind of a flexible spending account. So if pre-tax dollars are used to pay for the child care expenses, then they can't get the tax credit. Then in the table there on line 26, you'll see a change of the date here. That just changes because the tax credit now is a function of the child's age, the issue comes up as to how old are they on which day. And the way it was drafted was their age at the close of the year, but for the federal child care credit, they use the age at the beginning of the year. So we're aligning it with federal. Then over on page 3, lines 23 and through 25, there are two pieces. Line 23 is more of a policy issue. It is not a technical fix. And it would disallow the credit to taxpayers who claim either a capital loss or a net operating loss. The capital loss, if you choose to move forward here, the difference between capital loss and net capital loss are key. And I think Deanna is going to talk about that a little bit. And then lines 24 and 25 simply states that they have to have earned income that is taxable in Oregon to claim the credit, which is consistent with the policy. It kind of clarifies that. And then there's also a minor change on line 3, deleting some language that Deanna is going to touch on also. It deletes the director of the related to the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Great. You're back up.
I am. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, here to talk to you about House Bill 2054. And like Chris said, there are two parts. The first part is rather large. Even though it seems very simple, it's a pretty substantive change to the way we do business. And just to give some background, the Department of Revenue has rulemaking authority in this particular provision, and we're saying we really don't need this rulemaking authority. We really realized that this was happening because the Secretary of State was required. They're getting a new system for administrative rules, and all our rules are tied to the statute number. They're making us change all of our rule numbers. So we went through this process to conform with their standards. Fine, it's a project. But we discovered this rule. that we have on the books, and we started looking at updating it, and we thought, gosh, why do we have this authority? This is unusual that we have this much authority to designate what is deemed a business tax credit. So we talked to Chris and Paul about this. A tax credit is granted to a personal income taxpayers to encourage certain investment, create employment, economic opportunity or incentive for charitable, educational, scientific, literary, or public purposes that's listed here, that's designated as a business tax credit by statute or by the Department of Revenue by rule. It's very broad.
It sure is.
Yeah, and it's kind of an odd place to be because every session since for years now, you guys have gone in and every time you add a new credit, you do add it to this list to make it sure that it's in there. So we have I have provided some testimony to break down for you what would happen when we have a repeal of our ability to write rules. Because we have written rules that allow these types of credits to be provided. So they're broken down between the business tax credits that you provide for in statute, the ones we provide for in rule, and the ones that are allowed, but we haven't yet adopted them into rule. Some of them are they're old, they're sunsetted, and there's just carry forwards that are still allowed in there. But those are the credits that we have determined are business tax credit by rule. So this particular version of the bill doesn't also list those credits in this this statute. So you'd want to consider if as a matter of policy if you do agree that they are business tax credits. But that is where we're looking at cleaning that up and just taking away our rule writing authority. We think it's a little too broad for what we normally do.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to pause while you're on that part, and these are credits that would be applicable to S-Corps, correct?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Smith Warner, the credits would then flow through from the S-Corporation to the shareholder of the S-Corporation and be claimed in their pro rata share on their personal income tax return. Correct.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that. There's a long history related to this. I believe this was a Department of Revenue concept back in 1991. We went back and listened to the legislative history, and it was to address issues that arose, ironically, with the adoption of the Rural Medical Practitioner Tax Credit in 1989. So as time has gone by,
okay.
I know you were just
one more reason not to like that.
So over the years, you know, you've added more, and we have as well. So we just want to clarify, you know, it's pretty clear that there's pretty broad authority in that bill. It's including but not limited to, but it is a little odd. So we're wanting to raise that to your attention and then provide you with the list. So we're happy to have conversations further about that.
I'd like to ask another question just to make certain that we understand this. The statute, I think, purports to allow the department to establish tax credits, or is it simply to designate that a tax credit is a business tax credit?
Mr. Chair, it's the latter.
The latter.
It's
Thank you.
Not to create a new tax credit,
That's
but it's
helpful.
To establish one as a business tax credit.
Okay. Then let's go back to your list. Mm-hmm. You've got a list of, looks like about a dozen or a few more of the ones that are called business tax credits listed in administrative rule. Mm-hmm. So the effect of the repeal of this italicized language in this bill would be that unless we add something else to the statute, these tax credits would no longer be considered business tax credits. What would they be considered instead, and what would the implication of that be to those S-Corporation shareholders?
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. If you take away our rule writing authority,
I don't know what I'm asking for. Yeah,
no, you got it right.
Okay.
If you take away our rule writing authority to determine which credits are a business tax credit, then all of these we would repeal this rule, and no one would be allowed to take these credits. So we would talk to you probably about allowing carry forward credits, the tail on some of them that overlap when the rule was repealed. But we would certainly welcome a conversation about what you believe is truly a business tax credit and whether it should be just listed in statute rather than here by our agency as by rule. So the taxpayers wouldn't be able to claim them anymore if we repealed that rule.
But the shareholders of an S corporation.
Correct.
How about a corporation that was a C corporation, would it be able to continue claiming these credits, assuming they haven't sunsetted?
Mr. Chair, I believe I'd have to look at each one individually to make sure that there's that
and transmission. How about a tax credit that was purchased, that was owned by an individual, not by a corporation? For example, a sole proprietor who owns a water transit vessel. No, no, let's pick one that's not expired yet. Workforce housing.
Don't know that, Mr. Chair, that these apply to that are applicable. They have to come from a corporate return and be passing through to shareholders.
Okay.
Right, fine. Chris. Okay, Chris is nodding. So
the University Venture Development Fund contributions can come from an individual or from a business.
Right.
So I assume that the individual piece would remain.
Correct.
Okay. This gets complicated really fast.
I think the key piece, and I tried to set it up that way, the starting point are the C corporation taxes,
right?
Tax credits, and there are a number of tax credits are available to both, but there are a body of tax credits that are C corporation only, and by the rulemaking authority, those were extended to S corporations.
Gotcha.
Now, in that statute, the legislature has, in my time, has done that very specifically, and they're listed here. One by one. That's what other parts of the statute that aren't being deleted.
So if we wanted to pass this bill to be completely certain about it, we'd want to examine these business tax credits listed in administrative rule and decide which ones of those should be added in this bill as by an amendment.
Yes.
In order to effectuate the rule that the current rule that we have.
Correct. If you wanted to go for a no change, like a no policy change, you take this list of tax credits and they get added in statute.
Into that statute.
And then you would get a no effect, you'd get a law change, right, but no effective change in who gets to claim the credits.
All right. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, correct? But for Chris's last statement, it would seem to me to be very draconian to eliminate all of these without a careful review of each one and the constituency that goes with them.
That was the point of my question.
Okay.
Yeah, and I agree. This is a much bigger bill than it looks on the surface.
It certainly is, Mr. Chair, and that is exactly why I provided that list for you, to draw your attention to the fact that these are the ones we have in rule. You need to look at them to consider them.
Okay.
Let me ask just one more question.
Please, yeah.
I apologize. I really want to get my arms around. These are the tax, I want to repeat what you said. These are the tax credits the Department of Revenue manages by rule, not by statute.
Correct. Well, Mr. Chair,
or S-corps.
Representative Smith, I don't know what you mean by manages, but we determine that they are a business tax credit by rule.
Okay.
They exist. We may or may not administer the tax credit, but we've determined that they are a business tax credit under this definition that currently exists.
Right. These tax credits exist in statute.
Correct.
And your job under the statute as it exists now is to say, yes, indeed, if you are a shareholder of an S corporation that has one of these credits, they can pass it through to you, and you can use it on your own personal tax return.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Was there something else? I thought I saw another hand. Okay. And the reason for the department wanting this change is in order to deal with the Secretary of State's request to change the administrative system?
No, it's not the reason. It just was the reason that it came up, that we were alerted to it. We were looking at all of our rules. We have about 1,000 rules on our books, and we had to renumber all of them.
All right.
And as part of that process, we discovered this and thought, this is odd, and talked to LRO about it, and they agreed it was odd, and so that's why we're sitting here today.
Okay. Let's talk about the other pieces of the bill, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
It just strikes me that this is a significant amount of work for the committee, and I wonder if we actually will have time for it this year. We might. I don't know.
Okay, so the working family, just to give, I think, a little bit of background, Chris did talk about this. There were, in 2015, the legislature took two childcare expense type credits and merged them into one. It was a working family childcare credit and the child independent care credit. And it's now called the working family household independent care credit. Many of the qualities that came with the working family credit and the child independent care credit continue on in this bill. Ties to the Internal Revenue Code, limitations, a lot of different kind of things. But some of the things we didn't catch when we were converting. Some of them were issues with the prior credit that could be considered policy changes or policy considerations for you. So I'm going to go over them. Chris kind of went over them line by line, but I am going to explain them a little bit in more detail. So on page 2, in section 2, lines 16 through 18, we talk about the limitations of $12,000 and $24,000 are reduced by the amount that's excludable under section 129. And what that is you've heard it colloquially called a cafeteria plan or flexible spending account for daycare benefits. You can put up to $5,000 of your taxable income into this flexible spending account and have that money be pre-tax. You don't pay income tax on it. It's excluded from gross income. So what this provision does is it then says, okay, if you have, in the example, say $12,000 of expenses, you have to reduce those expenses by the amount you didn't pay tax on already, the $5,000, up to $5,000, whatever you actually had put in there. And the only eligible expenses that you should use for calculating the Oregon credit is $7,000 in that example. It prevents the double dipping that Chris was talking about earlier, so you, where you don't have to pay tax on the income, but then you also get a tax credit. Currently, the way it's written, they could use the whole $12,000, get the federal, the exclusion from gross income and the tax credit, and we don't think that that was the intent. Do you have any questions on that component? Okay. The next component is on the same page. It's on lines 25 and 26, and it talks about the changing of the age of the youngest child at the close of the tax year, and it really should be the age of the youngest qualifying individual at the beginning of the tax year. And it's important because in lines it becomes important in lines 30 through 32, where it says at least 6 years, but less than 13. Under federal law, a child who turns 13 in a year, expenses that you pay for a child in daycare up to age 13 are eligible for the federal credits, federal child care credits. By having the child turn 13 during that year, then we no longer are allowed to use those credits or those expenses for that child. So they might be able to use 6 months worth of credit or, excuse me, expenses for federal purposes, but not Oregon. So this change would align that. Okay, so that if they have expenses for a child who turns 13 in the year, they can take all of the expenses up to age 12 or through age 12. I'm going to skip go to page 3, but I'm going to skip lines 23, 24, 25, and I'm going to go down to line 30 because that's easier. Then we'll skip back up to the policy choices that are available in 23, 24, and 25. So I don't know if the Department of Revenue is unique, but we have a statute that says any time that it says the director has to do something and the director doesn't actually do it, we have to file a statement with the Secretary of State's office indicating that she has delegated her authority to someone else to do this. This is the imposition of a penalty for someone who has not claimed this properly or is doing it fraudulently. And we really don't think you mean to have our director be the one that actually asserts that. We think it's just someone in our staff level, so we want to take that out. There are places that it is appropriate that she does do the work, supervisory authority and our doubtful liability appeals are a couple of examples. That's pretty straightforward.
I suspect the director agrees with this change.
Yes. there's several places where it's just an old style kind of thing, sure. And it just got picked up in this particular bill. So the more substantive changes that are, right. I kind of view right. as policy changes are the change to, and this is something that was applicable in the old working family credit, but didn't get carried over into this new working family household independent care credit in line 24 and 25 on page 3. A taxpayer who's a non-resident who doesn't report income that's taxable, earned income that's taxable to Oregon, currently is allowed, under this statute now, is allowed to claim the credit, even though they aren't reporting any earned income to Oregon. So they may file a return that has, say, rental income. Maybe they have a rental property and they work in Seattle. they're not going to report that earned income to Oregon, but they're going to be eligible for the credit because currently it doesn't say that they have to have Oregon earned income. That is a carry forward from our previous credit that we think was overlooked. But it is a policy change. If you want non-residents to claim it in that sense, then certainly you could, but we do think that was overlooked. In line 23, to a taxpayer, the credit would not be allowed to a taxpayer who claims a capital loss or a net operating loss in the year. I believe that is a policy decision. That was an issue with our prior credit as well. We think, one, that you don't mean capital loss, that anybody who claims a capital loss, we think it means to be net capital loss, because Schedule D, they could still report a gain, and we wouldn't necessarily know that. So I think that there's just a word missing there. But the bigger one, that the net capital loss is limited to $3,000 per return per year, and there's some carry forward provisions. So it's not a huge effector of a change to this credit. But what is a big change we see on returns is when people claim a net operating loss deduction. A net operating loss, for folks who are who don't know, is a business loss that is taken in a period when the company's tax deductions exceed their income substantially. And then generally that net operating loss can be carried back 3 years, and then it can also be carried forward into the future. So what we see is people who maybe have substantial income in tax year 2015, who then, or in a particular tax year, and they carry that loss back, it reduces their income to a point where they fall into these poverty levels artificially, and they're eligible for large tax credits. And I think this is an outlier situation. I don't think that there's of the total number of people that are claiming these returns, there's not a large number. They're outlier situations, but we really don't think that that's what you intended. There are other areas of the law where you've said net operating losses are not allowable. So it could be other losses too, like rental losses. Those are not allowed for federal, the earned income tax credit. They're not allowed to offset and claim those things either. So that to me is a pretty substantial change to the credit. It existed before. It's carried forward into this new credit. But we do think it addresses issues that you have with outlier situations that we don't really think you're intending to help these high income folks who have these business deductions that are carried back or carried forward to future years, if that makes sense. Do you have any other questions on that before I continue?
Yes, Representative Nelson, please.
I just want to understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is, if we, by changing this statute and doing this, we're basically preventing someone from sort of trying to take a tax credit for child care when it's not appropriate, because what they're doing is trying to subsidize a business loss that occurred at some point in the recent past for something else. Am I understanding that right,
Mr. Chair?
It's like closing a loophole.
No, it's not. I don't know that people are trying to do that. They're definitely able to do that. But what is interesting about it, it's just that, for example, I'm just gonna use years that because there's overlap here. I'm gonna say there's a net operating loss here in 2016 of, let's just say, $100,000. And the taxpayer has a choice. They can take it and carry back to 2013 tax year and file a claim for refund and recoup the tax they paid on their 2013 return. Assume they had $50,000 of adjusted gross income in that year. They carry that $100,000 back. Now their income is $50,000. Maybe they're a family of five. That might put them in a bracket here where they get this credit, and they didn't need it in the year that they claimed it, or in 2013. It's just kind of an after the fact thing. So then we also pay interest on the refund because it's back to the date of the original return, which was 2013. And then some other issues around that. I'll talk about that later.
I think we're hearing a real story is what it sounds like. Please, Representative.
So one more follow-up. So, well, maybe two. So this is only an S-Corp is going to be able to do this, right?
That's why we're... Mr. Chair and Representative knows there are two completely disparate issues in this bill, and that was the prior one.
Okay. All right.
These are for low-income taxpayers, individual taxpayers. This is not a corporate tax credit.
Right. So you're talking about proprietorships, essentially, aren't you?
Not necessarily sole proprietorships. The business loss can come from any source. It can come from a partnership, an S corporation, and be applied to their personal return and their share.
Okay.
It could be a Schedule C.
The only thing
as well.
That doesn't work is a C corporation.
Right.
Because it's a different taxpayer. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
So we think that we should have a conversation about those. I do think for the most part, the policy is getting to, like I said, I think that this is outliers. There's not that many. I believe we had pulled some data. There was a few. I think I might have some of that here, actually. Let me, my staff.
Well, there may not be very many cases like this, but a Wiley CPA could pay his fees for a number of years by finding this one.
This isn't broken down. They did pull some information for me, but this is not broken down by the type of income. The NOL is in the other income line, and a net operating loss deduction. So there's two terminologies here. There's net operating loss. That's the year the loss was incurred. In my example, it's 2016. And then there's also what's called an NOLD, which is the net operating loss deduction, which is claimed in, I think my example is 2013. So that's when the deduction is claimed. So we did a query, and there's a little less than 1,000 that have some sort of loss that's greater than $3,000 on their returns each year for various things, including NOLs. But we can work with you more on that particular issue.
How do the feds handle this issue?
Mr. Chair, the feds, I'd have to double check. They don't have a child care credit like ours.
That's true.
They have an earned income tax credit. That's a refundable tax credit. I would venture a guess that they're not allowed, but I'd have to double check that if the NOL can carry back to create an earned income tax credit.
And is this the statute that we adopted last time?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, in 2015. Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
So this you know, the normal rule is it takes three sessions to get a tax law right. This would just be additional evidence of that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair. Okay.
Dr. Sambula?
Yeah, and the history of this, Representative Kenny Geyer and I worked to combine these, and it got a lot more complex, so I'm not surprised that there's some missed factors here.
Yes, you did extremely good work. That doesn't mean there aren't details.
It took a long time. It was a lot of work.
The finer nuances, for sure. So, Mr. Chair, if I could continue, the additional things that we wanted to bring to your attention related to this new credit and the merging of the two were things that may have been issues with the prior credit that have continued on with this credit. So I just wanted to make sure you were aware of them. The first one, let me refresh my memory on this one. Under federal law, because I talked earlier about how this credit, if we make this change to a credit not being available to a non-resident who doesn't have Oregon earned income, the income that's taxable to Oregon, they also, there's a cap in federal law to which we tie that says that their child care expenses can't exceed their earned income. Their taxable earned income. And so on a non-resident return, in the example that I had where they had some rental income but they had wages in Seattle that wasn't reportable to Oregon, you would want to cap the expenses to whatever was taxable in Oregon. That does not is not the case now. It's whatever is on their federal return that is capped. So those would be allowed under current law. So that one, I believe, is an oversight from the prior credit to this one. That was something that was clear in the old credit, but that we didn't pick up in this new credit. So we would suggest that the expenses are limited to the amount of earned income that's taxable to Oregon for non-resident and part-year residents, as opposed to those folks who, as opposed to federal earned income. One other thing, actually two more things, under the Internal Revenue Code to which this credit ties, a person who is married can look for work. They can claim child care expenses while they're working, while they're looking for work, or while they're attending school. A non-married taxpayer does not have the option to look for work, attend school, or be disabled, where the married folks do. So we just want to ask you to consider whether you want to treat non-married individuals in the same way that you treat married individuals there.
Would you point at the language?
It's not in this bill. This is an issue that we're just raising to your attention.
This is part of the amendments that you're going to offer later.
Yes, oh, okay. Correct.
All right.
That was an
yes.
error.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You see why I say three sessions.
Well, and to be frank here, this credit is not available until tax year 2016. The old one sunset 2015. So we're just now starting to see 2016 returns being filed claiming this credit. So these are things that we learned throughout the year as we were working and programming our systems and writing our forms and instructions. Some of these things that we learned based on our prior experience and how the prior credit worked moving forward and applying that to this. So the last thing is currently Oregon law does not allow interest to be paid on refunds that are attributable to the earned income tax credit. That's a refundable tax credit in the same sense that the working family household and dependent care credit is a refundable tax credit. I believe that the reason the policy choice there on the earned income tax credit was that it's not a refund of tax that was paid into the system originally. It's just an assistance program that the legislature uses the tax return as a vehicle to distribute to folks. And so because they are not out of having use of the money throughout the year like they would in a withholding tax situation or an estimated tax situation, interest is not paid on those refunds. However, on this credit, interest is paid on the refunds. So if we have in the example where I talked about the carryback to a prior year and they get a working family credit, we would allow interest on that. If it takes us a while to investigate to make sure during the return processing, if we go beyond our 45-day limit, we would pay interest on that as well. So I just wanted to alert you to the disparity in the two refundable credits and how interest is calculated on one and not the other, and ask which policy do you think is the right one, or we can administer it either way. It's just inconsistent.
Right. Yes.
I wanted to reflect back onto your comments about the married versus non-married, mm-hmm. and that applies to the credit is now effective in 2016.
Correct.
Is that what you said? Mm-hmm. So does that mean we're going to get returns for non-married people who are unable to take advantage of the tax benefit?
Mr. Chair and Representative Marsh, if they are attending school, if they're paying daycare to attend school, daycare expenses, or they need someone to care for them because they're disabled, that is correct under current law.
Follow-up. Is there any way to fix that retroactively? I mean, that seems blatant. Is it clear mistake, I think,
yeah.
and a punishment to those taxpayers.
Mr. Chair, and I would defer to legislative counsel and your staff on that, but I think that's possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Chris?
It certainly could be made retroactive. It could be applicable to 2016, and it would just be a situation where the taxpayers would need to file an amended return to claim it because mm-hmm. By the time it would become law, we will be past the filing deadlines for 2016. But those changes could certainly be made retroactive to 2016.
Yeah, and of course, some of them may very well have asked for it, and you may have turned them down because they're not married.
Well, Mr. Chair, not yet, but
not yet,
possibly,
but that's
yes.
happening yeah. this year.
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Buell?
It was not our intent, so I can right. put that on the record. It was there. We extended this. It was our intent to extend this tax credit option to those going to school,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't our intent if it was married or
undiscriminated.
I think that's. I think on this bill, you're going to be a very useful resource because this thing was worked pretty hard in the other committee, and I don't think we have to rework it. We just have to make sure that the language mm-hmm. follows the intent.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, and I agree. I think there was. I was part of that process, and there was a lot of work that went into the 2015 work. A lot of work, especially from Chris. So the fact that we've missed some of these finer nuances is not at all surprising. So just want to bring them to your attention and make sure you knew that they were out there.
Yeah. Representative Smith Warner.
I was going to ask, and we had been having some conversations about how this might impact the fiscal of, you know, what our projected revenue costs of it, or
this is pretty small, isn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't expect any of these changes to affect the actual cost or the estimated cost. It would have been in rounding error. For magnitude, mm-hmm. this tax credit I think it's about $20 to $22 million a year.
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
Right.
A year.
Chair, if I may, that's one of the reasons why we combined them, because they were so small. We just thought the you lower the administrative burden for the Department of Revenue by combining these as one driver of why. Mm-hmm.
Actually, this kind of a change would reduce your administrative effort, wouldn't it? You wouldn't have to figure out whether the taxpayer was married or not.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that has it's certainly something we can administer. It's not a burden.
Actually, I need to correct it. I think the merging of the two tax credits brings the cost to about $30 to $32 million a year.
Yeah.
I think the $20 million I was quoting was the old working family child care credit. The merging of them pushed it was still largely a no change cost.
Right.
Total combined.
When you added them together.
Correct. So right. It's $30 to $32 million a year, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's not in this in this current bill.
Correct.
We may want to talk about this some more, but it looks to me as though we need several different amendments. And my suggestion to the LRO is that we write separate amendments based on this, and that the one for the first piece, they're actually write two for the first piece. One is to accede to the request to get the department out of the rulemaking process. The second one would be to take the department out of the rulemaking process and add the items that were on that list to the statute, and then we need to figure out whether we have time to actually manage that or not. So I guess the third one would be that's the first one. The first one is simply to remove the change. If we don't have time to work it, we should just remove the change, and then work it later when we have time. This looks to me like it might be an interim study group process. That might be done fairly quickly if you weren't trying to do a whole bunch of other things at the same time. I'm just aware that the committee has a lot of work to do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You have a long list.
Really hard.
Yeah, I've got it.
On this,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Bueller.
Can I just ask a general question I have you right here?
Sure.
We have a very low rate compared to other states in terms of utilizing the earned income tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
My looking at this.
I'm meeting with the speaker.
The main factor, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a fair number of people who just don't file a return because they don't need to. They don't have income. But that precludes them from drawing down those federal EITC funds. Is that correct? Am I correct in that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, part of the earned income tax credit the purpose of that credit is to incentivize people to work.
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't have income, they aren't eligible for the credit. But if they have earned income, if they have a job, there's a bell curve on how much they can claim. It starts at a very low number, graduates up, and then comes back down to phase out to where they don't, in theory, don't need that assistance anymore. So if they do have income, they should be filing a return. We do have means to be able to tell if we have filing enforcement, if people are required to file a return. We can't assume that they're eligible for all of these credits, presumably mostly because the federal credit in this particular situation when we do filing enforcement is very familial based. So it's like, we don't know where a custodial child is living throughout the year, and part of one of the criteria is for them to identify, to tell us who has the child more than half the year, and sometimes they're equal, sometimes they're not. It's very case-by-case driven, so when we do our filing enforcement, we don't grant to when we tell someone that they need to file a return, that they haven't filed a return, we look at the basic things that everyone's eligible for, like the standard deduction and the personal exemption credit. If they don't contact us and tell us that they need to that they do need to file a return based on the information we have, then we go to a point where we can set up a return on their behalf. But we don't ever assume that they qualify for any of the legislative policies you have enacted. They're an act of legislative grace. That's a standard, and we are an enforcer of that grace. It's awkward for us to turn around and say you should claim something and then come back and say no, you shouldn't have after all. So it's very nuanced, and there's a lot of things. Oregon is unique in the sense that we're the only state that licenses preparers of returns, tax preparers, CPAs. So it could be that we have better compliance. with it, and it's got a, that particular credit has a very high fraud rate at the federal level. So there's some finer nuances to that particular credit and report as well that we're working on.
Quick follow-up. Maybe I'll generalize my question. And do you have insight why Oregon would have such a low rate of utilization of EITC compared to other states?
Do we have enough on the
right? Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, I haven't had time to look at the methodology in that report that you're referring to. I know it came out a week or so ago. I've heard about it. I would have to defer to people who are smarter than me and economists that know how that the methodology behind that study and how it came up. I can't speak to that analysis.
It's a significant amount of money. It's approaching $100 million if we just have utilization rates similar to other states.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, if I may, in 2015, this came up again in response to that same report, I believe, and there was a bill that asked us to promote the use of that credit. And what we have done, short of promoting the credit, because we do have some concerns with, like I said, telling someone you should qualify for something and then coming on the back end and saying, well, no, not really. We tricked you there. So what we have done, though, is we have participated in the IRS Earned Income Tax Credit Awareness Day. Mm-hmm. We use all our social media tools to make sure that people are aware of that. We put it in our materials. We have it on our website, our homepage. We've talked about free file for low-income folks so that they can get out there to file those returns that maybe they haven't been filing. It's right on our front page, free file, and it links you to resources like Cash Oregon and AARP for low-income folks. We also are working with the Oregon Health Authority. They have a one eligibility website that they're putting out, I believe, in 2018. I'd have to get an update on that. And they're also going to provide information to the federal credit. The federal credit is where all where it's real big there. Oregon is a small percentage. I think it's 8% of the federal credit.
We increase it to 11%.
And the Earned Income Tax Credit Assistant that the IRS has on their website is very helpful. It walks people through all of the criteria that they need to understand so that they can identify if they qualify for that federal credit. Mm-hmm. And if they do qualify for that federal credit, then they can take it on the Oregon return. So they're putting that link on their website. We have it on our website. We're doing as much as we can to make people aware about it, short of, telling them that they should claim it. But we've really stepped up our efforts at trying to inform folks that it's out there.
And you'll keep us in the loop on how that's going.
Certainly.
To the extent you can.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Anything else on this bill today? Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2054. Colleagues, we're going to carry over House Bills 2281 and 2282 till tomorrow. We're going to continue now with the informational meeting on orientation from LRO. But we're not going to finish that today. It will be also carried over until tomorrow, in addition to the part that's happening today. And so with that, we'll open that informational meeting. And I'm not sure, Paul, where you want to go next. Continuing with that, and then I got to go to my meeting. So you're up.
Okay.
Just for that one piece.
Sure.
I made it easy.
One piece.
Not do anything else.
Just
this piece.
End of it.
And I've already carried it over till tomorrow.
Right, but orientation.
Right, he's right there. He's going to go and talk about property tax.
And we shut down in a quarter.
A quarter tail, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so, excuse me. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue. And yeah, picking up, I guess, where we left off yesterday, got through the general orientation on property tax, and then the next section I had was for property tax relief. So again, in the document, the LRO basic facts, you'll find it in the media materials, and this is page E1 or 54 in the PDF. So property tax relief programs, really at this time, Oregon is down to one property tax relief program. the Elderly Rental Assistance Program just finished up. SB 296 of 2015 actually folded that into existing programs of Oregon Housing and Community Services. So the last checks for that program just went out this past fall. So there is some background detail in the document related to the HART program and the Property Tax Relief Program, which I think the chair alluded to yesterday a bit. But these programs were back, for the most part, in the 80s is when the most amount of the dollars were coming out. So it's a bit dated at that point. So the one remaining program that still exists is the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Relief Program. And the scroll down here. I shouldn't call it a relief program. It's a deferral program. So the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program it's a deferral program. So the way it's set up is the property taxes are paid for qualifying individuals. So whether you're a senior or disabled individual who qualifies for the program, your property taxes are paid by the state of Oregon. So the local governments do receive the dollars as if the bill was paid as normal. And then what is owed back is dollars back to the state to cover that balance. So once you enter the program, assuming you continue to qualify each year, a senior or a disabled individual would have their property taxes paid going forward. And then at the time of something that triggers their exiting the program, a sale of a home, or in some cases a death and the subsequent sale of a home, those deferred property taxes are repaid back to the state. So it's a little bit different in that it's not a necessarily a tax lien. It is a deferral program, so it works a little bit differently. So the deferral program, I'll just hit the general concepts. There's both the senior part of the program and then the disabled portion. On the senior side, it is age-based. So it's 62 or older. There are income requirements. The most recent, it is indexed to inflation. So the current household income for the 16-17 tax year was set at $43,000. There's also limits on the real market value of the home. That's a function. There are hard limits, and then there's a function of the number of years you've been in the home. So the more years you've been in the home, the higher that RMB value goes up for being able to qualify. There is an overall wealth limit. And then there's also a requirement that an individual have to be in the home for 5 years minimum before entering the program. And then there's also currently a three-year recertification requirement. So within every 3 years, a person that's in the program must recertify. So they have to fill out some documentation and send it back to the Department of Revenue. Now, this program has gone through a number of changes in the past 6 or 7, 8 years, I guess, going back to 2009. I do have them listed in the document, so you can see 2011 was probably the year with the most changes there in House Bill 2543. And some of those changes include changing the requirements that I alluded to, some of the real market value, the five-year minimum, the home, and those such things have been included in recent legislation, or relatively recent legislation, I should say, in the last 10 years. And part of the reason for that is I'll actually scroll down to one of the last pages in this section. Oops. I can make this large enough to see. So the chart I have up on the screen right now, excuse me, you have the blue bar represents the total paid by the state. So these are the dollars that are going back out in deferral. So it's the property taxes that are being paid by the state. And the red bar represents the annual repayments that are coming back in. So those are individuals that have sold their home, or maybe they've passed away or something to that effect, and they're making the repayment back to the program. And you can see throughout the 90s and into the mid-2000s, the red bar was significantly or quite a bit higher than the payments going out. So the repayments coming into the program were higher than the payments going out each year. Now this allowed in a number of years for dollars to come back into the general fund to be repaid from the initial seed money, if you will, for the program. And then also there was a change in, I believe it was in the late 2000s, that was using some of that money to support Operation Project Independence. So if there was X amount of dollars up to, I think it was $3.5 million was left in the deferral program, anything above that would be transferred over to Project Independence. Now, all this occurred right about the time that we had a bit of a housing downturn. And so you can see the total paid by the state, that blue bar, beginning in the 07-08 year, and then I believe it's 08-09, actually reversed. So the payments that were required to go out of the program to cover the qualified applicant's property taxes were exceeding the dollars coming in for that same fiscal year. So the program was all of a sudden running into a bit of a cash flow issue. And that necessitated some of the changes that you've seen that are in the bullets in the document to, I guess, shore up the program, if you will. And what the result has been is that there's been a number the number of applicants and the number of people in the program, you can see the high of the dollars going out in about that 2010-11, following some of the changes, came down to about the same. So the number of people in the program was reduced quite a bit, and that's reflective in the figures there that you see, the bars there. The payments going out of the program now are quite a bit less than what were at its peak. Repayments, again, are steadying quite a bit. Part of that is the return, I guess, to some somewhat of normalcy in the housing market, and then also just by the nature of a number of individuals being pulling out of the program because they no longer qualify because of the new requirements, we've seen some of those repayments coming in as well. So at this time, for the past 5 years or so, repayments have exceeded the total going back out. And I think at the last, this past November, when the most recent property tax payments were made, after that, there was about $23 million, I believe, left in the program. So after having to make those November payments, that's how much was left over.
Didn't we have a loan of some sort? Seems like we had a loan. We paid it back.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Mr. Vice Chair, that was in 2009. There was a 2-year loan from Treasury, and yes, that was repaid.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're getting ready for another sweep now, just about in time for just joking.
Yes. Well, this time, Mr. Vice Chair, there's not an automatic sweep function set right to the account anymore.
I hope not. So. Yeah. Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Representative. So does that balance then still fund Project Independence?
No, Rep. Johnson, that was part of the changes as well, as it discontinued that automatic sweep.
Okay.
So this time the dollars would just
they would just
build. Yeah.
Occurring.
Questions? Okay. Okay. So we're done with that one.
So, Mr. Chair, we have next. We've got about 10 minutes, but we're probably enough to cover the estate tax.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office, here today to talk about the estate tax. And so generally in Oregon, estates with gross values greater than or equal to $1 million are required to file an estate tax. And if they're valued at $1 million or greater in Oregon, they have to pay some amount of estate tax. The estate tax table here, you can see the different schedules that apply to various amounts of value in the estate. It ranges from 10% to 16% on all those portions of the estate. And so it's there's a difference between the way that Oregon residents and non-residents are taxed in their estates. The ratio for Oregon residents includes intangible personal property, while the non-resident ratio does not include that amount. It's also possible to receive a natural resource credit, and that's available for natural resource properties. It includes farm and forest land uses or commercial fishing businesses and things like that. So the credit is available to any estate with a value or less than $15 million. And the value of the natural resource property in Oregon would have to constitute less than 50% of the value of the estate in Oregon in order to be eligible for that. And so there's a federal tax on estates, and this applies to estates with a gross value equal to $5.43 million or more, and that is indexed every year with inflation. So here's also just a bit of a history of the inheritance and estate tax and the way that the tax was adopted at this time. And so getting to the way it is today, there's a kind of a wide history. And in 2012 was the most recent major change. House Bill 2541 changed the Oregon inheritance tax into the Oregon estate transfer tax. And the bill contained many of the recommendations provided by a work group of for the inheritance tax. And it included in the reforms a credit for the natural resource properties. There are some detailed tables here. You can see the kind of the recent history of the estate tax. And the 2015 has been kind of a larger year for the amounts. It grew from $113 million to $141 million in revenue. And so that's seems to be a trend that the revenues are going up roughly every year. It remains to be seen whether that will continue, especially at that level. The 2015 value may be a little bit larger than normal, but it was a revenue amount collected on around 1,500 returns. And 44 of these returns claim the natural resources credit, and the amount of the natural resource credit claimed was $4.6 million.
So the amount of tax paid in the biennium, roughly $250 million. I just added those 2 years together. Is that about right? So when someone asks what value does the Oregon estate tax have, we would respond by saying per biennium around $250 million. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, Vice Chair Benz, that's correct. Although in the typical biennium, the amount would be smaller. As you can see, the history shows that that it has been smaller. The bulk of the payable tax by estate size has been on the estates valued at $10 million or greater. In 2015, it was 39% of the value of the estates was in those larger estates. So this could be a little bit more of a volatile revenue source depending on the circumstances of these large estates from year to year.
If I may, looking at this, if we go back to the Great Recession, 2007, 2008, 2009, mostly lower numbers, and then as the stock market and everything creeps back up, higher numbers. Is there a correlation? Do you guys study that, or you just check the mailbox?
Vice Chair Benz, there does seem to be some association with the recessions. It could, be a result of the a reduced value of properties in particular or assets of an estate, and so it would follow that it does have some impact on it. But that seems to be recovering at this point. Although I don't know about the tax year 2015 would continue in that upward direction.
Right.
It may be moderated somewhat by next year.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add something. Back in my forecasting days, which I'm still recovering from, we did spend a lot of time on this, and it certainly makes sense. And what Christine says is right. There's going to be some correlation with the business cycle. It's obviously going to be tied to asset values, particularly land values, home values, equity values. But the correlation is loose, and there's some real long lags and very difficult to predict year to year. So what we do find is you may get one or two of these 20-plus million in a given year, and we saw this, in fact, happen this current fiscal year, and that'll cause the number to bump up. But it's very erratic, subject to some very general trends.
Thank you.
There's a little bit more of a detailed history here. You can see the estates into various value categories. The most recent 2 years, the $20 million plus category has been combined or not the most recent, but in 2012 and also in 2015, that the categories have been combined because they needed to preserve confidentiality in those estimates. So there's just some statistics there about the average tax by estate size, and it goes up, obviously, as the estate gets larger. And then there's the percent of the total tax by the estate sizes, and the greatest percent of the total tax, the bulk of it, has been in estates that are between $2 and $3.5 million. They've made up 21% of the total, which is larger than any other category. And the percent of the total number of returns, the bulk of the returns are between the $1 million and $1.5 million size of the estate. And so there's some more details here. This one's more of a fiscal year picture, and it's just the inheritance and estate tax collections as they vary by fiscal year. Then the receipts have been increasing. Here you can see this graph as well, and then expressed in terms as a percentage of the general fund, it's a little bit moderated as the general fund has been increasing over those years as well.
Can you go back to that chart the one right above the one? Yeah, that one right there. Am I reading that correctly? There were 441 estates that paid in 2015 that paid the $140 million. Is that correct? Tax year, and gives us, and then the number, that's the number of tax returns, isn't it? The second column.
Vice Chair Benz, the number, that would be the number that have less than $1 million in Oregon estate value.
And is there a total on that line there someplace?
Yes, so if you go over here, this
1,563,
yeah. That's the total number of returns that have been filed.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Chair. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just one more, please.
So, Christine, just to confirm, so I just wanted to make sure I'm understanding the natural resource credit correctly. Mm-hmm. So, basically, if you have a farm or a natural resources family business and you die and it is passed on to your inheritors, you are going to get a significant credit towards the value of your account, and that will continue as long as you're keeping it in the family. So this kind of the boogeyman of our inheritance taxes are so high that you can't afford to pass down the family farm, that would not the what I read of this would not seem that would not seem to be a realistic presentation of our estate laws.
Yes,
I don't. I'm sorry. That's rather a leading question. I believe a judge might say to me. But I guess I'm just trying. I mean, my reading of that is that it we do indeed account for agricultural industries, family, particularly family run, in our inheritance tax laws.
So, Madam Vice Chair, yes, that was the intent. Okay. We haven't gone back and really evaluated how effective it's been. But that was definitely the intent.
And if I may briefly follow up, and I would assume that the idea of it must be more than 50% of the value, my assumption is that's to keep, like, martini ranchers from utilizing this.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Technical term.
If I may, the mm-hmm. Having been involved way too much in this, I'll simply say there's about 15 or 20 specific twists and turns to it, and then a lot more. Mm. So to draw too many generalizations, very difficult.
On either direction, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And so that...
We're done.
That concludes, yes, the section. And if you have any other questions, I can entertain those.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thanks.
We are adjourned.